If you look for it, every day has cause for celebration. Celebrate a friend for their promotion, baby wedding, life thing. Celebrate yourself for keeping the couch warm. It's no easy feat, especially if it's a big couch. Or maybe you just want to celebrate living in 2023, where you can get beer, wine, and spirits delivered from Drizly in under 60 minutes without leaving said couch. So download the Drizly app or go to drizly.com. That's drizly.com and get your favorite drinks delivered today.
92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
All because of a fancy bike?
It's not just a bike. Peloton makes treadmills too.
Eh, all treadmills are the same.
Our treadmills can adjust speed and incline automatically, so you never break your stride. Whether you're squeezing in a power walk or training for a marathon, Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try the Peloton Tread risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.
Kick out the jams, motherfuckers. This is Wayne Kramer from the MC5, and you're listening to Rock and Roll Archaeology.
Pantheon Podcasts presents Deeper Digs in Rock, part of the Rock and Roll Archaeology Project. Music. Culture. Technology and rock and roll. Now, on with the show.
Hello, I love you. Won't you tell me your name? That's for all the diggers that wrote in last week. Christian Swain here, the rock and roll archaeologist, coming to you from our San Francisco laboratories. We have received some very nice fan mail as of late, so we must be doing something right. Again, if you don't know, you can contact us through Facebook at the RNRAP, Instagram at RNR Archaeology, and on Twitter at RNR Archaeology. Hell, you can even call us and leave a message at 650-822-7625. Okay, here's the news. I've been telling you about our new shows as well as our good old tried and true rock and roll shows. We have 12 in the network now and another on the way. I'll be talking about that in a bit. All the info can be found at our website, pantheonpodcasts.com. We are growing our rock and roll podcast empire nicely, and you diggers are responding so much so that we smashed our listening number record last month. Just totally blew it out the water. I can't thank you guys enough. It's really overwhelming. It was really just a huge, huge increase in the listenership. We really appreciate it. So you guys are really out there telling your friends, and we love that. You can find all of our podcasts either in our Big Pipe, our audio magazine format, or the shows are individually available in their own feeds for a la carte, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. We're on every platform out there, so it shouldn't be a problem finding us. Obviously, you're listening to this one, but I mean the other shows. You can also find this show, Deeper Digs in Rock, and its sister show, Rock and Roll Archaeology, on the Osiris Podcast Network. And now you can find us at the Jambase website. If you don't know, Jambase is an online database and news portal for live music and festivals. It focuses mostly in the jam band genre. But go to jambase.com, scroll down the homepage, and you'll find us there online. So I want to introduce you all to Nugs.net. Nugs.net is the destination for live music on demand. They have a growing collection of over 15,000 full-length concert recordings from bands like Pearl Jam, Metallica, and Dead & Company. So you'll never run out of live music to explore. You can listen to a show from last night or from 40 years ago. I've been watching some shows from Sonic Youth recently because I never got to catch them live. Let me tell you, there is something for every music fan to explore. It's available on desktop, iOS and Android apps, Sonos and Blue OS. And just like us here at Pantheon, the folks at Nugs.net are live music fanatics. So they are offering new subscribers a 35% discount on an annual subscription. Go to nugs.net/deeperdigs and sign up today. And if you already have a subscription, give the gift of live music to a friend. Again, nugs.net/deeperdigs for 35% off an annual subscription. That's it for this week. Let's get to our guest. All right, this week, we have a very special guest, someone we've been trying to get on the show for a while now. I am very excited to talk with Canadian journalist Martin Popoff, author of over 80 books on rock and roll. Martin has been called heavy metal's most widely recognized journalist. Over 20 of the 80 books under his belt both critically evaluate heavy metal and document its history. He is without doubt an expert in the genre. He grew up in British Columbia and, like many of us in the early 1970s, was introduced to rock and roll through the osmosis of an older sibling's record collection. First, it was Led Zeppelin and Iron Butterfly, and then he discovered the heaviest of the times, Black Sabbath. Then it was on to Kiss, Deep Purple, Nazareth, Queen, and Canadian super musical heroes Rush, April Wine, and on and on. Like many of us, he grew up reading Rolling Stone, Circus Magazine, Hip Raider, NME, and Kerrang, but interestingly, never identified with any of the big-name writers of the day. Instead, he developed his own voice, and it certainly shows. Martin did the college thing, even received a master's degree while playing drums in local bands. In 1993, he released his first book, Riff Kills Man, 25 Years of Recorded Hard Rock and Heavy Metal. It was a collection of almost 2,000 critical reviews he had written over the years growing up. He then started his own heavy metal magazine, Brave Words and Bloody Knuckles, which ran from 1994 through 2008. Throughout his time at BWMBK, as it's known to fans, he continued to write his review books and expanded into collector guides and unofficial rock biographies of such acts as UFO, Deep Purple, Yes, and most recently, The Clash, which we will be discussing today. So while he is most known for his heavy metal and hard rock writings, he also has a deep passion for punk and prog rock. Okay, let's get with our guest, ladies and gents, Martin Popoff. Yeah. Martin Popoff, welcome to Deeper Digs in Rock.
Hey, thanks very much, Christian. This is very cool. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I guess my first question has to be, how did rock and roll choose you?
Wow. Well, I would say, okay, so I'm 56 now, so born in 63. I'd say by 73, I was already, the bug had bit me real hard. Mm-hmm. And boy, I remember, this is a bit of a crazy story, but I remember in grade four, you were either allowed to do show and tell or play DJ. Mm. And I played DJ, and I remember playing Volume 4 in grade four to my shocked classmates. But
no, Volume 4 has to be Led Zeppelin's Volume 4.
No, this is Black Sabbath.
Oh, well, Black Sabbath. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah. Black Sabbath Volume 4.
But basically, buying Circus and Cream and Hit Parader, quickly became an expert. You know, by 76, 77, my era, I was a crazy rock and roll expert kind of guy. But growing up in a small town, so not a lot of concerts, just a handful until more or less the early 80s. And then when the new wave of British heavy metal hit, you know, we're able to drive down on our own to Spokane, Washington, and they had all these great legendary record stores there, Strawberry Jams, Magic Mushrooms, you'd be buying Sounds and Kerrang and Melody Maker and all that, buying all sorts of imports. So, you know, having a tendency to hard rock, and I also was around and totally into original punk at the time as well.
Okay,
I was a drummer,
okay.
So I was into prog as well. Mm-hmm. Prog came, you know, around first year university, I'd say, 1981, but punk was immediate, late 76, 77. Being a metal guy by tendency, you know, when the new wave of British heavy metal hit, all of a sudden there was all sorts of metal to buy. And then, of course, from around your part, San Francisco, there was thrash eventually, but L.A., hair metal. So the 80s were a great time for heavy metal.
Oh, God, yeah, yeah. So you mentioned something that I want to go back to and have you explain, and that is, you know, the new wave of heavy metal, which is a iteration of metal. And I think you kind of have a theory that, you know, you break it into at least three categories of how heavy metal becomes such a dominating force, especially in the 1980s. And I think it starts with about 1970. We'd probably both agree with this, with Black Sabbath, Deep Purple, and Led Zeppelin all being, you know, rising to the occasion, wouldn't you say?
Yes, and Uriah Heep, as we were talking before we went on air.
Our little green room session, yes, yeah.
Yes, I went and inducted Uriah Heep into the Hall of Heavy Metal History. And, you know, one of the points I made there was that they are as original as Black Sabbath and Deep Purple. And I usually leave Led Zeppelin out of that conversation because they aren't as insistently heavy metal as those other three. But
they have their acoustic side, most famously on that Led Zeppelin 3. And, obviously some of the other songs in the other albums that come out, although they seem to get a little heavier as time goes on, wouldn't you say?
Yes. And they're early. And also, you know, if you want to include Led Zeppelin, you also start moving towards the Stooges and MC5 and that sort of stuff, too. But
that's the punk side of things. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, those guys are claimed by metal as well. And I claim them by metal as well. But basically, Sabbath is, Friday the 13th, February the 13th, 1970. Heap is July 1970. Deep Purple in Rock, their first truly metal album, and very, very heavy for 1970, is also July of 1970. So, yeah, that's the first thing. But to get back to, you know, the thing I brought up, the new wave of British heavy metal, that is 1980. Or late 79 thing. Mm-hmm. And that's where metal has this massive explosion in Britain, and there's all sorts of bands, Motorhead, Saxon, Deep, Iron Maiden, Def Leppard, Tigers of Pantang, all those. Yeah. And Judas Priest has an interesting place in there because they're almost like what I call the second wave of original heavy metal, or the second wave of metal, which is Judas Priest comes in 74, comes really hard in 76. And at that point, your little wave in there, your little cozy wave, is Priest, Rainbow, UFO, Thin Lizzy, and then Stateside, Ed Nugent, Aerosmith, Kiss, Blue Oyster Cult. So there's that sort of
that middle ground, right.
Yeah. Those are, you know, the three that you referred to before, if you want to talk about original three and put them in order, I usually consider the three waves being the original, this little bump in the mid-70s, and then the new wave of British heavy metal.
What about the thrash metal scene that comes out of the 80s?
Right. So that's 83, 84. Metallica essentially starts that with Kill 'Em All. And quickly, you know, Anthrax joins them. Exodus eventually joins them. Exodus is early, but they don't join them. They kind of screw up and don't get the album out till 85. But yeah, it's those bands, and then preceded by the likes of Anvil, Venom, Motorhead, Diamond Head, Tank, Warfare, those sorts of bands, a little bit of the hardcore punk, you know, the post-punk that's not the artsy post-punk, but the post-punk that is the hardcore, that's in there as well. So yeah, thrash is the next thing that essentially, thrash and hair metal together.
Yeah, I was going to ask about hair metal.
Yeah, they just sweep away the new wave of British heavy metal. All of a sudden, you know, someone comes in and just turns the lights off on the UK and it's all over, like starkly all over. And the axis moves to San Francisco and LA.
Well, do you think maybe MTV had a lot to do with that?
Yes, MTV starts the summer of 1981. But metal doesn't really start going even in the hair metal days until about 83 with Quiet Riot and Rat and Twisted Sister from New York, Dokken, Motley Crue's already going at that point. Van Halen's your original hair metal band, but, you know, they're obviously an anomaly. They're way out of time. They start in 78. Yeah. But what MTV is very important because MTV does not turn away and shun metal. The likes of, you know, say the Hall of Fame might, or Rolling Stone magazine, or, you know, any number of sources, radio. There's all sorts of things that are, you know, never become metal friendly. MTV was friendly to a whole pile of different things. So I never want to say MTV was metal centric, but MTV was metal friendly.
It was metal friendly, and then you know, it created you know, the Headbangers Ball specifically for the metal crowd. You know, I think wasn't it Friday nights or Saturday nights? You know, when all those kids were home, they could have their own piece of MTV for a few hours, right?
Exactly. Yeah, and then of course hair metal was very photogenic, videogenic, whatever.
Yeah, and that's the point. Yeah,
you had lots of that. So.
Yeah, and maybe that's why maybe the British rockers weren't quite up to what they got out of the LA scene, which was, you know, let's face it, pretty boys in makeup.
Yes, and the British guys, I mean, to their credit, they said there's no way we're going to put on makeup and tease up our hair and that. But also, there's always the running joke that the British guys are just not as good looking as what you're going to get out of in sunny California or whatever. And there was some truth to that. I mean, most of the British bands were not did not look the part of the hair metal bands, you know, to put it politely. But yeah, for various reasons, and some of those bands tried that sort of music and it just fell flat on its face. You know, you're the likes of Wrathchild and Shy and Raven went to this kind of athletic rock look, and who else was in there? Tiger Tales and Thunder eventually, London Choir Boys. It, just this disparate bunch of, you know, goons, you know, bands that kind of tried at it and it just they all fell flat on their face. It's only Def Leppard that broke out of that by being just also just a strange anomaly.
Yeah, I guess Def Leppard, you know, a recent inductee into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, did conquer America by being more pop centric, I think, than the others, wouldn't you say?
Yes, except and I really it rubs me the wrong way when Joe Elliott says, oh, we were never a new wave British heavy metal band. We didn't want to. Fine, if you don't want to associate with that. But their first album, like, you know, if you took all the spokes of the wheel of all the different, you know, disparate sounds of the new wave of British heavy metal and the actual hub would be a record like On Through the Night. It was dead center new wave of British heavy metal. But it was on a major label and they were already very professional and quite accomplished. The next album, you know, is clearly enough of a new wave of British heavy metal band album. But then, yes, they got very poppy in the Mutt Lange production. Then it got kind of worse and worse, or better and better, depending on what I say worse. But, you know, yeah, it rubs me the wrong way when they don't want to be associated with that because they clearly were, and there's nothing wrong with that. And, you know, he knows it, and everybody knows it, that probably the most revered Def Leppard album of all time will be High and Dry, followed by Pyromania or the first one, and then it goes down from there. So, so that's Def Leppard.
Well, you know, there's a band that you haven't mentioned that, you know, even today is still huge, and that's AC/DC.
Yes, and another anomaly. I mean, basically a band with a sound all their own, an incredibly simple sound. It was almost too simple when we, you know, we were hearing that for the first time. It was not until Let There Be Rock where, you know, it was heavy enough, because that was the first really heavy album where there was a lot of fuzz on the guitars, and it was just very distorted and very powerful. But yeah, just a band that kind of
a good bar. Well, they come out of the Australian bar scene. I mean, they're again in being down under and away from all of these other influences. I mean, you know, this wasn't the internet days where you could, you know, pretty much figure anything out in 5 minutes. You know, you really had to work for it, and you were separated, you know, through space. You know, therefore somebody from Australia would, you know, come out completely different than those in the UK,
yes,
those
and
in America.
Yes and no. An interesting thing about them is, yes, I mean, I even asked Malcolm this once in an interview, and he kind of explained it kind of neat to me. It's like, you have to play the boogies in the bars or they'll just throw bottles at you or coins or whatever, or you'll get booed off the stage. So the trick of AC/DC,
the boogie, they have that in spades, yes.
Well, it's the simplicity too. And I remember talking to Dave Mustaine once about this as well. It's like you play a double bass drum thrash song, and it's such a wall of sound that it might sound great on record, but it doesn't sound that great on stage. AC/DC on record might sound a little bit too uneventful on record, but on stage it's got just the enough amount of action where a bad PA system or whatever, you will get a thumping rock and roll show out of that simplicity. And then the other thing I want to make a point about AC/DC is So they do come from this strange tradition. I mean, it's not that a lot of bands were like them. It's funny. There were bands after them that were like AC/DC, like Angel City and Rose Tattoo and Heaven. But AC/DC was kind of unique. But the thing is, they quickly went over to the UK, and they essentially became a UK band. They were around the UK all the time.
That is true. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And Europe. And then they came to America fairly early on. But essentially, you know, they were participating in the rock and roll markets by about, 76, 77.
Now, of course, I can't leave this particular piece of our discussion here without your hometown heroes, Rush. Where do they fit into the pantheon of heavy metal?
Well, they are the inventors, the grandfathers, the undisputed champions of a genre called progressive metal. You know, before them, there was practically nobody that you could put in a camp that sounded like them. I mean, there were disparate elements, King Crimson, Vandergraaf Generator, Heavy Yes, Heavy Genesis, The Who even, Cream even to a certain extent, Led Zeppelin even to a certain extent, but nobody quite... basically, what Rush
all,
did,
all they, examples that they put on that that singular cover album that they did.
Yeah, yeah, and those, you know, those are mostly their stated influence as well. Not so much the Vandergraaf and King Crimson, but you know, the funny thing about them, you know, we just said what's the trick of AC/DC? Rush is a very simple trick. It's basically making progressive rock albums with your distortion pedal turned on. That's all it is. That's all they did, and they.
So they would have been Yes or Genesis if they left the distortion pedals
exactly,
off.
Exactly. So essentially, and nobody. I mean, they were. It was almost like they had the audacity to, quote unquote, I know this is a touchy word talking about Rush, but overplay, right? You know, anybody who hates Rush says they overplay tastelessly. Everybody who loves Rush says they're geniuses. And then there's a middle sensible ground that says, you know what? And I kind of take this tack a little bit, is that nobody dared play as much as Neil Peart on a normal simple rock song. So he was the only one doing it. And that made them very unique. So, and then you had Geddy's voice. So basically Rush is a band
I might add Neil's lyrics as well.
Yep, great lyrics. But a lot of people wrote great lyrics as well, too.
I'm not sure in metal the ideals that Mr. Peart put in are really duplicated in other metal bands.
Right. Yeah, I was more so leaning, I guess, towards prog. I think his lyrics are similar to prog lyrics.
True.
Thought about it very much, but the neat thing about Rush, of course, is that they essentially created a sound. They hammered that sound home for about four or five albums, and then they started changing a lot, you know, to their credit and to their detriment. They will admit they made some mistakes, and I think they did too. But they are fearless, creative people and growers. And basically, no one ever really was able to duplicate or follow Rush. Those who did were taking things in a different direction, starting with, say, Queensryche, Fate's Warning, Dream Theater, and on and on. And you get a whole strange progressive metal thing. But basically, while Rush was operating, I would say the only bands that really you could compare them to in a big way would be maybe, and not even in a big way, would be Styx and Kansas.
Yeah, I can see their contemporary Styx and Kansas being included into what the trio was doing. But you know, to your point, they are the fountainhead of a progressive metal, yeah. And the other two don't quite fit into that category. Here we are at 2019, and we're talking about bands that kind of start in 1970. Blossoms in the later 70s, turns into a giant thing in the 80s. And, and we still have the thrash metal scene is still kind of going out there. But, since we brought up Rush, as everybody is aware, Neil Peart has retired, and that's probably the end of Rush, period, which brings me to the point that this music has this athleticism to it that is difficult to continue to do, like a professional athlete into, old age. I mean, the Rolling Stones are about ready to hit the tour again, playing stadiums, but they can because their blues-based music, you can play into your 80s. I just don't think you can do that with the metal music. Do you agree with that or not?
Yeah, that's a really good point, and it is pretty true, and it goes for prog as well. But I always liken heavy metal to some of it is theoretically good, and you look at it almost like say the most extreme math metal, relapse core, math core, whatever. Even your most extreme thrash. To me, I've often likened heavy metal to lifting up the hood on a hot car and a bunch of guys like gathering around it and admiring this beautiful engine, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's there. It's a theoretical thing, though. If you drove it too fast, you would get arrested. If you drove it too fast again, you'd lose your license. And your car sits in your driveway, right? So, there's this theoretical thing about a hot car in the middle of a big city that you can't use. I mean, you can't use it anywhere. You can't. It's illegal everywhere to drive it too fast, right? So there's this thing about how it's this technological marvel, and that gets to your point because heavy metal, there's a lot to remember because it's very, very progressive. Even when it's straight heavy metal, there's a lot going on. Like you bring up the thrash bands, I'm gonna review the new Death Angel album for our Banger TV thing tomorrow. We're gonna do a recording of that, and they aren't even the trickiest of thrash bands. It goes way beyond Death Angel, but there's a lot to remember. So there's one thing for old age. Another thing is vocal fry on your voice, screaming your lungs out. I mean, there's a lot of heavy metal that has vocal fry, and it's not straight singing. That's hard to do in your old age. And even the regular singing has an operatic quality to it. You talk about someone like Rob Halford or Bruce Dickinson or Jeff Tate or whatever, Three Tremors, So the operatic, the hitting the high notes, the writing it at the high end of everybody's range, and then the exertion for the drummers. I mean, drummers will tell you, I'm a drummer myself. I mean, they'll always kind of downplay the fact it's not that physical if you do it right. It's not that big a deal. But There is a lot of note density there. And forget about it being physical and causing you a heart attack. There's people like Neil Peart. You know, a lot of these drummers of this age have back problems and tendonitis problems, tennis elbow problems, arthritis. And then Alex is another good example. Alex from Rush. So again, all this heavy
Alex Lifeson, yeah.
complicated playing. Alex Lifeson. He's got you know, arthritis problems, right? So you're right. In all sorts of, it is a very athletic music, just like Prague. You know, Yes is slowing down. Because of this as well, right? So, prog and metal share.
Well, they're just adding new younger members. That seems to be a thing nowadays as well.
Well, metal does that too. Metal does that too.
So. Yeah. I just saw Queensryche here in a club, and they had several younger members that were helping to keep up the load, if you will.
Yeah. Queensryche's a great example because, I mean, the drummer problem was not for that reason. The other guitarist problem was not for that reason. I mean, I know you're not saying this is the reason, but it's not the reason even for Todd Latour, the singer. But the neat thing is that that's the key. If you bring in another singer, okay, number one, that's hard to do and have the fans not revolt. But if you bring one
Priest knows that better than anybody.
Yeah. But if you bring one in, it's a really smart idea to bring one in that's 10 years younger than everybody else
right.
and who has great vocal technique, because the singer is the weakest link of all of them. There are all sorts of examples of these bands that have to go by the wayside because of that weak link, the voice's instrument.
Yeah. As a singer myself, the hard thing with metal is that, you know, you as the vocalist have to be above the frequencies of those guitars. And that's where it's that, you know, the alto or soprano type of vocalist kind of fits in the genre, because you just got to be above those frequencies or you'll get lost.
Neat. That's an interesting point. Yeah. Very cool.
Well, Martin, we've obviously established your bona fides. So why writing? How did you get into to that?
Well, okay. So after university, so I did a BA in English and I did an MBA, and then I worked for Xerox for a little bit. And then me and a buddy started a desktop publishing. That's what it was called in the old days. Print-broking business. So I was comfortable with the idea of pages and layouts and books and things like that. Basically what happened was I started writing record reviews just for myself to kind of organize all these different disparate elements in one place, all these different genres that was happening. Long and short of it, I self-published a book in 1993 of 2000 heavy metal record reviews. That got reissued in 97, 94. Started on with another buddy. We started a magazine called Brave Words and Bloody Knuckles, which was a print magazine that ran from 94 to 08. And that was a thriving, high-traffic website. Been around since the very beginnings of the net. Started getting all those interviews and writing even more. So 94 really picked up. And then as you go along, you know, the idea with doing all these books, I guess I got about 85 books now.
Yeah, you're very prolific.
Well, thank you. Yeah. So as it goes on, you know, you get.
I just want it one more time. 85 books.
yeah. So, you know, I've always had this idea that I don't want to write a book on a band unless I can bring some new stuff to the table, i.e. interview footage. So I normally wouldn't write a book on a band unless I've talked to them myself 20, 25, 30 times. And so that kind of happens as you move along and you're talking to them about their new record and their new tour and all that stuff, writing for the magazine. So we did that. Other website gigs came along. So, you know, that's how it happened. It just ramped up. And so one other point, in 2000, that's when I went full time. I quit the other thing. We sold our little business. And I went full time rock critic at that point. Cause you see those lines crossing on a chart saying, dang, you know, I don't make a lot of money doing this business thing, and I only make a tiny little bit doing this rock thing, but man, if I spent all my time in this rock thing, would it be that amount? And it's like, well, it'll be close. Okay, let's do it. So That's what I did. So in 2000, I essentially went full time, you know, and getting all these books out. I think one of the other reasons I can do so much is because all of that, you know, with the change in the industry, all that other stuff kind of fell away. The pay went down, down, down. I even write for free quite often now if I really want an interview with somebody. You know, all of that falls away. And what's left is the books, because, you know, I put out a lot of stuff through publishers, but I'm also not scared to self-publish. So at that point, you know, if I'm writing something that I know is totally uncommercial and I just want to do it myself, I've got my database to sell to, et cetera. I've got this built-in thing where I only have to rely on myself to do this. So I'm one of the few guys where the writing of the books thing is like the full-time job, versus most of these other guys, even guys with 10 or 12 or 20 books out, they're doing a lot of other stuff on the side. Let's not even forget about regular day jobs. They even do, you know, many of them even do that too, right? So that's why I'm able to get so much out.
That's crazy. So you self-published your reviews, your album reviews. That was your first book. But yeah. what was the first band that you felt that you were comfortable enough to, you know, write an entire book about?
Oddly enough, that turned out to be Blue Oyster Cult, which is because I love Blue Oyster Cult. The stories behind the songs are amazing. The stories behind the lyrics, the music, everything about that band is really, really interesting. And to this day, it probably is the most interesting band I've written a book on. So what happened?
Really?
So,
I mean, you've written books on Queen, Pink Floyd, The Clash, many of the heavy metal bands that we've already spoken about today. Why Blue Oyster Cult?
Well, Richard Meltzer, Patti Smith, Helen Wheels, Sandy Pearlman in the Imaginos saga, Buck Dharma, Don't Fear the Reaper, Godzilla, the biker conspiracy stuff, the UFO stuff, the secret society stuff. It's just deadly interesting. It's all just really, really cool stuff. And, you know, and this is a band that was big enough that they were essentially...
Are you telling me that there's more to the name Cult than just a neat hard rock band's name?
for sure. And, you know, so oddly what happened was Brian Slagle from Metal Blade is a buddy of mine. So we had this little run where we put out through Metal Blade Records, Metal Blade Books. I don't even think we even called it that. We just put Metal Blade Records on the back. Blue Oyster Cult book, UFO book, Dio book, and Rainbow book. So those were all very early for me. And the Blue Oyster Cult since, so it went from Brian. When it was long out of print, I self-published it, and now it's out through my UK publisher, Weimer, again. So it's been through three iterations, that book. And it was always, you know, a good enough seller all along, because a lot of people do realize they're just an interesting story. So, yeah, that was the first one. Deep Purple was fairly soon after that. I did an authorized Rush book. That goes back to 2003, so that's pretty long time ago as well. So, yeah, those were the early ones.
So why, you know, there's a lot of musical genres out there. Why was metal the music that spoke to you the most? Is it, you said you're a drummer. Is it because the drumming, is that, you know, kind of your style of drumming?
Part of that, heavy metal drumming is interesting. I don't know. There's just something about loud guitars that is interesting to young boys, you know, 13, 14, 15, where it was. I mean, now it's rap and pop, but back then it was anyways. And you know, these long-haired guys, you know, mustaches sometimes on them, but, you know, big stage shows like Kiss, Aerosmith looked cool, Ted Nugent looked amazing. So, you know, and I guess lyrically it's fairly juvenile, I suppose. And you are juvenile when you're not 13 or 14. But no, there's just something about, I don't know quite what it is. But again, it does remind me of that gathering around, you know, looking under the hood of a hot car. You know, young boys like hot cars too. So, heavy metal, just something about a guitar through a distortion pedal is just magical.
So, if I might throw something out there, it's almost as if these are Marvel superheroes to our generation, as opposed to, you know, today's actual Marvel superheroes being, you know, the cultural touchstone. That was the case with these metal players. They all were larger than life, and I, you know, would probably Kiss being the greatest example of that.
Yeah, and you know,
comic book characters, really.
Yes. Yeah. Well, yeah, definitely. Kiss obviously is extreme, but no, to put a finer point on it again, this idea of why heavy metal. I've always had this strange idea that, you know how you can make I had this talk with Steve Vai, how a high note on a guitar is almost like the clearest form of sound, or a piano note is the clearest form of sound. And then everything else, a saxophone, a guitar through a distortion pedal, has like baggage with it. It has something different about it, right? A richness, right? Well, and I've often thought also, why do I hate pop so much? Like, it actually makes me angry, right?
Really?
But putting aside that, when I try...
Today's pop, I can understand, but even back in the day, was...
Well, let's not get into that. But the point I'm trying to make is, but sometimes I can listen to a pop song of today and go, that is the most... If you made it's the difference between coffee and beer and orange juice as well. There's just something about if you tried to design the most perfect, best tasting music, it might be pop, or it might be orange juice versus beer and coffee, which you know you give that to a kid and they spit it out. They say this tastes terrible, right? So getting back around to heavy metal, I've always had this idea that if you wanted to make the most impressive sounding music to a guy, to make him go, wow, that is cool, right? You'd make like a fast Judas Priest song with Rob Halford singing high. You'd have this guitarist who's shredding away, who's playing at the far end of guitar accomplishment. Not a tasteful blues thing like B.B. King, but I'm talking straight impressive, straight acrobatics, right? Like, this guy sounds like a genius. Right?
Yeah.
You're not going to say that about B.B. King. You're going to say that about Eddie Van Halen. The word genius, right?
So you know what I mean? I might disagree with you in not assuming B.B. King is a genius in his own right playing a single note. But I see your point that with Eddie Van Halen, it's obvious. Anybody can get that.
Yes, but the other way of saying this is you can be a bullshit artist and create abstract art and sell it for tens of millions of dollars, but you can't bullshit your way into a Robert Bateman painting or a Rembrandt painting, right? You have to be able to do
it. You have to have the skill. With metal, you had to put the time in to get that good.
So you can't bullshit being Eddie Van Halen, but many, many people, and then you can all argue about, oh, are you really as soulful as B.B. King? Blah, blah, blah. It's all abstract. It's all opinion. But there's no opinion about having to be good to play heavy metal. Forget about like the drummers in the 70s or whatever, but pick all the drummers in thrash bands now. You have to be amazing. Guitarists, you always had to be amazing. Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. You didn't have to be really particularly amazing to play Led Zeppelin, but you had to be amazing to play Judas Priest and to play Iron Maiden and to play all the thrash of today. To sing like Robert, you know, or like Rob Halford, you had to be technically amazing. To sing in a blues band, you didn't have to be technically amazing. You could abuse yourself. You could smoke, you could drink, you could stay up late, and you can go on and do it, and you can bullshit your way through it. But so again, getting back to the point, why heavy metal? There's this funny thing about it that it is craftsmanship.
Well, it's the car. Let's go back to the car motif. Exactly. It's a Ferrari, and to your point, you can only take it out at certain places. But when you do let it run, boy, does it run.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of people look at a Ferrari and say, okay, you're a goofball for wanting to own a red Ferrari, like Engve with his seven Ferraris or whatever. But, you know, if you had a nice small Audi or something, right? You know, a nice behaved, sensibly designed car, you're considered classy, right? So Rolling Stone is classy. The people who get into the Hall of Fame are classy. Jan Werner is classy. Laura Nero and Patti Smith are classy, right? Eric Clapton is classy, but is Warren DeMartini from Rat classy? No, he's not considered classy, but he can play rings around Eric Clapton. And yes, you know what? He can be as soulful as Eric Clapton.
Okay. All right. So, you know, we've spent a lot of time on the metal scene, but you also seem to have an affinity for punk as well.
Yes. Loved punk right from the beginning. And the reason is really sad and embarrassing from the beginning. But, you know, I'll say it, and this everybody says this in my shoes, is there was not enough heavy metal to go around, and punk was an approximation of heavy metal. At that time, I mean, there were you could count on four hands how many heavy metal albums came out in any of the years in the 70s, right? So when punk comes along, it's pretty dangerous and heavy sounding. You know, The Damned with New Rose and yeah. Stabbed Back, the Sex Pistols album, the First and Second Saints albums, like these were really heavy albums at the time, right? And it's funny. It is kind
of or names like The Dead Kennedys.
Yeah. Oh,
GBH, grandiose right. bodily harm, yes. You know, fear, you know, on and on. So they just sound dangerous.
Yes. But the funny thing is, when you get to those bands, heavy metal bands are running rings around them, circles around them in terms of heaviness. So they're now obsolete as far as, the angry metalhead goes. But, you know, but the funny thing is, I felt the exact same way. I loved grunge when it happened, right? And I felt the exact same way. You know, you take the Saints album against a Blue Oyster Cult album or a Kiss album, and it just sounded dangerous and way more heavy, yet it wasn't heavy metal. Same thing with grunge. You listen to a Soundgarden album or a Green River or a Mudhoney album against the most egregious of the hair metal albums, and you go, wow, this thing over here that doesn't even think it's heavy is heavier. It's way cooler. It's more dangerous. You don't know what's going to go on. These guys sound like heroin addicts, and guess what? They are. You know, and it just sounds dangerous, and you're scared of it, right? Yeah, so that was the cool thing about grunge. You know, even a lot of things that happen, even on the so-called pop Nirvana album, you know, his vocal is heavier all across that album, whether he's singing a pop song or not, is heavier than the most egregious hair metal vocal, because the hair metal vocals are just getting thinner and higher and more girly.
Well, more pop. You know, the power ballad took over, and that didn't help. And and let's call Guns N' Roses probably the fulcrum, with maybe Metallica and the thrash metal scene just underneath it, already beginning to make the change, which led to, you know, the opening for grunge to come and. As a kind of a radio friendly version of all of this.
Yeah. But, you know, to get back to it, I mean, punk. So 77, I would have been 14 years old, and we're seeing this stuff in the magazines, or seeing a little bit on TV.
Ramones, Sex Pistols.
Yeah. But getting to Spokane and buying, I remember the first punk things I got, I believe, would have been that French New Wave compilation. That had The Damned on it. I know The Damned are credited with the first punk album, but I remember getting the first Clash album right away. Got a Canadian issue, so it wasn't right away, I suppose. The Sex Pistols, I did get the import of the Sex Pistols right away, The Damned. So it was those ones. And then also a little bit of Ramones, certainly the first Dead Boys, Young, Loud, and Snotty. Mm-hmm. Ramones is a funny one because it fit into this thing where my friends and I could not get past his vocals and considered them kind of a novelty band because the vocals bothered us so much. It's very odd. Yet the rest of the musical, you know, presentation was actually one of the heaviest of all those bands. Even though it had a melody to it, you know, it was wall-to-wall power chords with the Ramones all the time, right?
Yeah, to me, it was, I just found them funny. They were, you know, I'd throw them on and have a good time. I was never bothered by Johnny's vocals, they just didn't seem real. And the lyrics are just hilarious.
Yeah, but, you know,
almost to a Monty Python-esque level.
Well, I just remember when I was 14, I didn't think they were funny because they had dark glasses on. They're from New York City. They were all in leather jackets. They were singing about sniffing glue and beating people up with baseball bats. They did not seem funny.
They were all had the same stupid name. They all looked exactly the same. It as opposed to some of the LA punk bands that I would see, like Fear or several others, that were literally dangerous. Yeah. You know, it just didn't seem.
So how old are you, like that. Christian?
I'm 57. So yeah, we're about the same age here. So
yeah. Well, so, you know, you're seeing those bands probably. You're
maybe a couple of years ahead of you too, yeah. Because I'm in LA and you're in yeah. Toronto, yeah, or and outside.
I was from a small town too.
Yeah,
don't
yeah.
So I'm not ever seeing. I never saw a punk band for years and years and years. So yeah, and but you're you know those bands you're seeing. The LA bands were dangerous as hell, and you know we had no LA bands in our record collection because none of them could get it together to put a record out. I mean, same with Toronto. There was one band we loved, the Diodes. It was a super heavy first album, and then they went poppy. But there were no LA albums in 77, 78, 79. Not well, 79. By then there was a little bit Dickies, I remember. And I mean if you were in a big city and you were hip enough to actually get into those things at a young age like that, I could see how it could scare the hell out of you for sure.
Oh yeah, go to a Black Flag concert sometime. But you agree that the punk element, you know, we've already established that with metal it starts in 1970, and you would agree that the punk side of things starts with the MC5, right?
Yes. So I wrote a book, 120,000 words, that ends in 1971 called Who Invented Heavy Metal, and I'm thinking of doing the same thing for punk. So I've you know peripherally. Looked into this a lot. So to give you not a crazy long answer, but I'll give you the abridged version.
Please.
What I think is garage rock through MC5 and the Stooges, through New York Dolls, through and then of course New York Dolls and the second version of coming of the Stooges is Raw Power, New York Dolls, and In Too Much Too Soon. And then a really important thing that I would always stress in this is you can look this up on YouTube is the television rehearsals from 1974. Television yeah. were way more of a punk band in 1974 than they would be in 1977. That is an incredible little bit of black and white footage that people should see. So 1974, and then there's also Ramones footage from about 75. And I think it might even be early 75. There's Dictators, who people forget about. I think they should be included. Then there's also a fair bit of a scene that I think should get more notice coming up in Akron, Cleveland, that whole, you know, Rocket from the Tombs turning into Perubu and Dead Boys. That's 75, 76. There's some other bands, Eels, blah, blah, blah. Now, the UK is an interesting case where... the UK claims sort of a lineage back to pub rock, which I think is a red herring and should be downgraded. I think I don't think there's not much. Pub rock's a funny term. Like it literally has to do. Pub rock can mean country rock, laid back country rock in the UK, or it can mean sped up R&B. Like Dr. Feelgood, getting into Eddie and the Hot Rods, maybe Ducks Deluxe, that kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And people always say, you know, that heavy sped up Dr. Feelgood is the start of punk rock. I don't think it really has much at all. I think literally what happens is England steals punk rock from the likes of being influenced by the Stooges, especially when Iggy stays there in 73.
Because of Bowie. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when the Dolls go there and the drummer dies, Billy Mercer in 72, and Malcolm McLaren stealing ideas from Richard Hell and applying them to the Sex Pistols. And yes, the influence of the very first time the Ramones go there. So there's all these things that there's no in so what I'm saying is there's no musical lineage at all in the UK, homegrown lineage of punk rock to their own music. There really isn't. But so it's all stolen from the States. But then what happens is that the UK, they're such fast learners that they essentially take over. And that one little bit of fashion sense that comes from Richard Hell and the spiky hair and the safety
pins. Yeah, 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 yeah.
That gets applied by Malcolm McLaren
and his wife, Vivian Westwood. Yes.
Right. Yeah. And then within weeks or months or days, partner, the Clash have their own punk style.
Yeah.
The Damned have their own punk style. And all of a sudden punk explodes over there. So So the stuff that you think you tick off all the boxes and say as a punk band, they quickly all become UK bands because every American band has some individuality to them, except for one, and that's the Dead Boys. The Dead Boys are almost like the Spinal Tap. You know, if you were to make a really schlocky movie about a punk. A punk band, you would make the Dead Boys, right? So the Dead Boys are the only band that are like that dead center, exactly a punk band in every way from America. But Britain starts having tons and tons of them, and they have this 45 RPM culture that causes an explosion of music that really didn't quite happen in the States as quickly, although it did. Everybody got into it. But I think in the UK they had more of an independent record thing, which was a big road paver for the new wave of British heavy metal as well. That's how all that happened. So that's my longer-winded answer than I'm on the origins of punk.
Let's talk about your latest book, which is on The Clash. And it's a breakdown of all the albums and all the songs. So tell us how that came about. And, you know, do you think that The Clash sits at the top of the heap when it comes to this particular musical genre?
Okay, so this publisher, Voyager Press, unfortunately, they are closing down their music book division. So I was getting all these great deals to do all these really cool books. So I did five books that are album by album books.
Yeah, yeah.
And what those ones are I interview, you know, celebrities, super fans, etc. And we do a Q&A on every studio album. I did five of those. And so that was Maiden, Queen, AC/DC, Rush, and somebody else, Pink Floyd. But what they also had me do, I did two books like this Clash one. I did a Led Zeppelin one the same way. All the albums, all the songs, they're called, right? And so what this is I had to, it's just absolutely straight me, monastic, sitting on the top of the mountain, writing an analysis of every single Clash song for about two pages, basically, with pictures,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
400, 500 words on every last damn Clash song. Although I got some complaints because we did leave it, pretty sacrosanct to the studio albums and didn't do all the B-sides and stuff, etc. But yeah, so that's that. So the first one I did was the Zeppelin, and then the second one I did was the Clash. So I loved it. It's as a writer, it's a very satisfying, creative, cool thing to do, to be able to just like spout off and throw in every single factoid, because if you're going to write, you know, it's about 90,000 words with no interview content except for some sidebar things, you know, no interview content. So it's literally, you know, you're like a hardcore musicologist, one song to the next, you got to put it down on paper, say everything you can about this. And that usually means all the instrumentation, the production, all the lyrics, all the singing, everything, because it's hard to write 400 or 500 words, 600 words
for,
on one
for a 3-minute song. Right.
Exactly. So that's it. So to answer your other question, yes, I would put Clash as my favorite punk band of all time. The Pistols album would be my favorite album, though. The Clash are way, way up there. I think they're miles ahead of pretty much every other band. Like every punk band.
The only band that matters.
Yeah. And like every punk band, they rapidly changed and moved into other things. They, you know, arguably.
Oh, the reggae side of things.
They only have two punk albums out of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 full length pieces of vinyl out of, what is that, 6 albums, 5 albums, because they did a double and a triple, right? But
yeah. But
basically only the first album, single album, second album, single album are really punk.
Yeah. So the other thing about the books are the presentation and how you put it together. And I think from what you've said earlier, this goes back to your desktop publishing days, right?
Well, no. For these books, the beauty of these books, why I loved doing them so much, is that I literally handed off the Word file to my mentor over there and the most awesome dude to work with, Dennis Pernew. It's really sad for both of us that this whole music book division thing has gone away, because I ended up doing like 10 books for those guys.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, I handed it off to Dennis, and he's such a crazy music fan as well. He goes and he knows what pictures people haven't seen before and all that stuff. So he finds all this great photography. He hunts down the memorabilia shots. They're all, you know, he makes sure he gets the highest resolution in. You know, he even takes a stab at writing, you know, all the captions, which I appreciate, although I have to go in and make sure, you know, I like them and make changes and check for typos and things. So I have to proof that part of it. But no, the presentations are awesome. They have killer designers over there, so the covers are always neat. You know, there's often little doodads like neon ink or embossing or foil and stuff like that, right? But yeah, the presentations of all of these books, either it's the five album by albums or the Illustrated Histories or the Clash and the Zeppelin, are first rate. I remember seeing the Zeppelin for the first time and going through it and going, you know what? I'd say more than half these pictures of Led Zeppelin here, I've never even seen before. So I love that about how cool these books look.
So, and there's no more to come then, huh?
No, there's no more to come. You know, I remember once before Dennis moved on to a children's book company, and then he came back, and I have faith somehow that, you know, I almost feel like they're taking a break and they will come back. I mean, there's a part of me that says this will all start again and we will be doing more music books eventually. But no, I mean, the Queen, which has been out a while, you know, there haven't been any deals for a long time, unfortunately.
You know, so that brings me to a question about, you know, where we are in rock music history. I think it's safe to say that, you know, it no longer holds the cultural sway that it once did. And that, you know, our generation looks at this as our touchstone of, you know, what made us who we are. And, you know, the current generation doesn't look at music that way. It's a part of their life, but it is not an all-encompassing part of their life. What is social media. So yeah. You agree with that, right?
Yeah, that's very interesting. And very, very well put. I mean, I've never really thought about it quite that way or that extensively, but you're right. I think what happens is, okay, first of all, there's tons and tons more music, so it's more fragmented, and it's yes. Nobody's sharing all the same stuff. So
it's not a monoculture anymore.
The same way.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And you know, you're right, social media is better. But also, you know, I think TV and movies have gotten way better over the decades, such that there's way more, you know, emphasis on Sopranos first, and then Game of Thrones and all this stuff. So all of that stuff, the delivery of all that, I think it's helped it a heck of a lot. Oddly, the delivery of music onto Spotify, you know, people talk about how it hurt the business, but I think it also somehow didn't help in terms of, put it this way. Yeah, okay, I've never thought about this before, but I don't think the ease and the cheapness in which we can get music has made music way more important in young people's lives, as you just stated. But the efficient delivery of TV and movies has made that better and has made that more a part of people's lives. And of course, social media as well. Sports has basically stayed the same. I don't think there's been any changes in how sports is delivered or how much people are into sports. So there are all these entertainment options. Video games is the other one. That was what I was thinking. So so that didn't exist in the 70s, and then it just got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And of course, that's a massive thing in people's lives. So yes, video games, TV, social media, those have grown tenfold over. So the competition for music is much, much, much bigger than it was back in the 70s.
But don't you agree that maybe we are seeing another iteration where, you know, it's funny. I mean, you know, I personally think that the music of the latter half of the 20th century will be as important as the Italian Renaissance. The further we get away from it, the more obvious it becomes. This was an electric moment. It's both a cultural explosion and a technological one. It shows up, you know, post-war. It has American culture fingerprints all over it, and maybe, you know, the American empire is in decline, and therefore, you know, it doesn't hold the same sway, and rock and roll doesn't as well. And I mean all forms of it. But in a weird sort of way, every once in a while, just about when you think, oh, it's dead and gone, it like shows up in some new iteration. And I think right now you've hit on it, is movies and television. There seems to be a plethora of these, you know, new ways of exposing this history. And I'll, you know, I'll take the Queen movie, Bohemian Rhapsody, as my first bit of evidence. A huge hit, unexpected. And now, every movie studio is thinking about, you know, how do they recreate that and, you know, make another rock a biopic.
Interesting. I mean, there's a lot to digest there. So I take it what you mean by this, as important as the Italian Renaissance, you're probably talking about blues, the birth of rock and roll, the 60s, the 70s, right through the end of the 2000s. Is that what you mean?
I think by the end of the grunge movement, I think that's really the last great iteration of rock and roll. I think rock and roll itself, it's a guitar-based music form. I think the electric guitar is a uniquely industrial type of instrument, which fits perfectly in the 20th century. As I said, it is, you know, American culture, which is, let's face it, the dominant culture on the planet after World War II, that becomes a global phenomenon. I also think it's the first art form that becomes a global phenomenon in real time. You can see it actually happening, whereas other art forms took, you know, ages to disseminate throughout the world, sort of thing. But so I think those are the pieces.
To be ruthless about it, though, you know, I have seen, you know, people are quite shocked recently about how the 60s playlists on radio and everywhere in popular consciousness has been chopped down to like, you know, 100 songs from 1,000 songs over the last 15, 20 years. So I think and like no one cares about big band music anymore. You know, doo-wop and 50s music is not that collectible. A lot of 60s music is not that collectible. New wave of British heavy metal and punk have gone through their ups and downs, and they're probably both permanently on a down. Yeah. So I think as time moves on, I think we're going to be a little more surprised and shocked and dismayed about how much stuff is completely forgotten and nobody cares anymore. I think
so,
that.
So you really think it's over?
Well, I think it can happen, but I think certain things, if they're continued to be drummed into our heads, like Led Zeppelin and AC/DC, and to some extent Queen and the Eagles, and even George Thorogood or whatever, right? Like certain, say, classic rock, or the big classics of grunge, or even the big classics of hair metal. If we continue to hear these things on radio, and they continue to be put into movies, and they continue to be played at sports events, and put into video games and things, they will last. But there's only so much brain room with so much creativity going on all the time. And as we've talked about all these competing entertainment sources, mm-hmm. that a lot of stuff will fall by the wayside. But I guess certain things will remain classics, but they, again, they'll only remain classics because they'll just be programmed into us like a cult, and they just won't go away. So if they keep, you know, cramming this stuff, if you keep cramming Led Zeppelin into the heads of, you know, 12-year-old boys and girls,
like Disney, some like of Mickey Mouse.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. Some of them will like it, but I've also seen, you know, there is an, you know, inexorable tide or whatever. I don't even know if I use that word right, but I mean, you know, rap is super important to kids, right?
And pop it is the street rock and roll of today. There's no two ways about that. Hip hop is where it's at musically. But again, I don't think that the music holds that the type of sway that music did to our generation.
No. And you know, I often bring up the example. It's like, it's kind of cool. Like, I remember in the very early days, you know, a new Bob Dylan album would come out, or a new Lou Reed album or something, right? Or a Zeppelin album. And, you know, not only would there be a massive review in every single magazine, but sometimes there'd be two reviews, two writers.
Yeah, two different perspectives, right?
In the same magazine, yeah. So, yeah. So we were all sharing that, right? And so, you know, just to throw out numbers there, you know, music was 30% or 50% or whatever of your entertainment sources. You had sports, you know, very little TV, and you had music. And that's all there was, really, for your entertainment dollars, right? And, you know, I remember going to New York City. I remember I was quite shocked about, maybe this was 5 years ago or something, you know, walking around the streets of New York for hours and hours and hours, right? And I'm in a rock T-shirt, and then I'm in another rock T-shirt the next day, and another rock T-shirt the next day. And I realized, looking around and going, I've walked by 10,000 people in the last hour and a half or whatever, right? I didn't spot one rock T-shirt, right?
You were the only one.
Yeah, it's crazy, right? And it would be like an event when someone actually was like championing a rock band on their shirt. So, you know, and then, you know, most of the time it was, you know, if there was anything being championed, it was just the completely insipid, you know, corporate logo on a shirt, right? Mm-hmm. So, it's funny. Yeah, it's I don't know. And then you can get in the debate about recorded music versus live music, and how live music is surprisingly still a very vital thing. So
people
still do like going out to concerts. But yeah, it's just it is a whole different world. That's for sure.
So after 30 years of music journalism, you know, what do you think you've discovered? What are the points that still mean something to you?
Boy, I don't know. I don't know if this answers what you're looking for, but I think there's still a reason for the journalist today. And that's as a gatekeeper, as someone to sift through and suggest things. But I also, you know, I've always been the kind of guy that I love immersive box sets, right? Mm-hmm. And box sets that are complete. And I always like them because I love devouring the liner notes and being told, having things pointed out to you so you appreciate this artwork that you bought more. Right. And that's why I like this Clash book and the Zeppelin book. I mean, and the album by album books, because there's basically a bunch of people saying, look what happens at a minute 13. Look what happens with the guitar here. Here's where he turns his wah-wah pedal on. Do you hear the tambourine back here in this Zeppelin song? Right. And here's where he hits a gong and they stick it in water and stuff. It's like, oh, cool. You know, I like that more than I did 10 seconds ago. Right. So I think there's still a good place for having stuff pointed out to you. That's all rock journalism is, right? Just to help you appreciate what you're listening to more. And it's the same with books and poetry. Poetry is just like that. When you go through poetry in university, it's like you read it and you go, this is completely nonsensical. I have no idea what's going on here. And then the prof points out, you know, 50 things, 40 of which the writer didn't even intend, but whatever. It's you know, it's still 50 things that you go, oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
You know. And it's the same with journalism. But I don't know how else to answer your question. I haven't really discovered anything else other than that.
Well, I think we're all now rock and roll archaeologists. You know, you are going in depth into each of these songs with these books, and it's unfortunate that there's not more on the horizon at the moment. To your point, you know, it's depth of knowledge and, learning all of the details of, you know, your favorite band or your favorite album or your favorite song.
Yeah. And, you know, anybody who's eager and enthusiastic can go on the internet and put together all the bits and pieces and read all the different chaotic stuff and come up with the same, amount of knowledge just gleaned off the internet for free. I mean, even wiki pages are a great start. If you want to learn a lot about a band, you know, if you hit every blue hyperlink on every wiki page, you're eventually, I actually saw somewhere that somebody actually went and printed and made books out of of the wiki pages, probably completely illegal. But but basically, you know, I think this is an example. This was years ago I saw this. But I think it's like if you gathered up all the information on the band Dio that's on the wiki pages without going way off base, you get 200 pages of stuff to read.
Yeah.
So, you know, so it's all there, right? But again, it's beautiful. It's nice to have in a book. It's nice to have because it takes your face away from the screen and it takes you away from either the phone or your desktop or your laptop or whatever. And that's why I like liner notes in box sets too, which is, you know, that apparently is still a pretty thriving part of the physical music industry is pretty elaborate box sets. And I think, yeah, people want to sit down in not this chair, not the business chair, but the chair over there, or lie down on the bed and pull out all this cool stuff and read it and listen to it at the same time on a better stereo, right? So that's kind of still the good thing about a print books or print in any form. It just gives your eyes a rest from the screens.
Well, Martin, you know, we didn't talk too much about the third leg that you're an expert in, which is the prog side of things. We'll leave that for another conversation. But what's next for you?
Well, so I did these two books, Riff Raff, the top 250 heavy metal songs of the 70s and Aces High of the 80s. And they were taken from a big poll. And I put in artist quotes and I reviewed them. So I'm going to do a 90s one, call it War Ensemble, the top 250 heavy metal songs of the 90s. I'm going to put out an Iron Maiden book. My old Iron Maiden book is way out of print. So I'm going to reconfigure and add and expand and write in narrative form just a proper Iron Maiden book for the first time. And that's going to be called Where Eagles Dare, Iron Maiden in the 80s. And then I'm also going to, it's a bit of a long story, I won't go into it, but I'm going to do three Rush books. And this is through a really cool publisher as well here in Canada, who I've worked with a lot, ECW Press. We're going to do a 70s Rush book, an 80s Rush book, and a 90s Rush book. Our 90s and 2000s combined.
There you go. Do you have a favorite band?
Yeah, when I'm asked that question, I often get a little cheeky and say it's got to be a band that that got in and got out before the 80s, before they could screw up. So I often say Max Webster is my favorite Canadian band, about six albums. Uh-huh. Gillen is one of my favorite bands. You know, Ian Gillen from Deep Purple, he had a band called Gillen, not the Ian Gillen band, but just Gillen again, about six albums. I love The Jam. I love XTC. I love The Clash. Who else?
There you go. Well, Martin Popoff, thanks for being with us on Deeper Digs in Rock today.
Awesome, man. This was a lot of fun. This was a great chat. Thank you very much.
What a great time with Martin Popoff. Let me tell you, he is a rock and roll archaeologist himself and certainly has a PhD in heavy metal. So here's the news I alluded to at the top. We've been so impressed with Martin's work that we have asked him to join our Rock and Roll Archaeology College, where he will become the head of our heavy metal department. His new show will be launched very shortly, and it's called History in 5 Songs with Martin Popoff. Keep an ear out, and of course, I'll let everyone know the details when it arrives. Of all the genres of rock, I think it's fair to say that metalheads are the most fanatical, and I am positively certain that they have created the largest set of subgenres in all of music history.
Yes, there are the classics. You know, the originators, Zeppelin, Sabbath, Purple, with some others. And then the first wave, you know, the new wave of British heavy metal. You know, think Iron Maiden, Judas Priest, things like that. Thrash with the three-headed monster of Metallica, Slayer, and Megadeth. But let me tell you, that is just skimming the surface. Without name-checking, you know, there's death metal and Christian metal, symphonic and rap, Viking and pirate. Yeah, that's right, pirate metal. And you can easily make a case for grunge as metal, and therefore punk is a close cousin, if not sibling. Basically, loud guitars, hard banging drums, and screaming vocals will get you where you need to go. A lot of people point to some of the dark imagery and lyrical content as despicable and or troubling. Sure, there are acts that are outright misogynists or worse, downright white supremacists or Nazis. But that's all ridiculousness, and at best has small audiences but makes good media play. Most rise an ugly head for a moment and are usually shouted down pretty quickly back into obscurity. Today, you can find a lot of fine female metal bands around these days, and let's face it, punk can shout down Nazi metal any day of the week. Most is harmless fun, made by serious people, providing high entertainment value for your dollar. It takes significant skill to be in a metal band, and just because the lyrics and imagery might be best used to fill the fantasies of adolescent males, doesn't make it all bad. There is a reason there are so many subsets of this music. Anyway, we now have a bona fide expert in the field of heavy metal, and I, for one, cannot wait to learn more from Professor Popoff. In the meantime, check out his big, bad library of books wherever you get your reading materials. Go out and grab his excellent coffee table book, The Clash, all the albums, all the songs. Okay, this week was heavy metal. Next week, I'm digging into rap and hip-hop with Rough House Records executive and hip-hop pioneer Chris Schwartz. Keep the cards and letters coming, tell a friend, and keep up the rockin'.
Last night, I took a walk into the back of my mind, through the trash and the warning signs. It was a party full of jokes and cliches. I couldn't think of anything to say. And so I slipped into the men's room there. I saw my hair the way it's never been before. Took the stairs from my head to my heart. I didn't know they were so far.
Hey diggers, Christian Swain here, with a short pause for a great cause. We believe music education for young people is an investment in a better future for all of us. If you listen to our podcasts, chances are you agree. Little Kids Rock has transformed the lives of more than 650,000 public school students by bringing music education into their schools. Little Kids Rock trains teachers in underfunded schools to teach kids the music they love, from the Beatles to Bruno Mars, Led Zeppelin to Lady Gaga, Chuck Berry to Chance the Rapper. Little Kids Rock has become a national movement to restore, expand, and innovate music education in public schools across America. Visit littlekidsrock.org and learn more about how you can help put music where it belongs, in our schools. Thank you, and let's keep up the rockin' right into the next generation.
Deeper Digs in Rock, produced and hosted by Christian Swain. All sound design and incidental music by Busy Signal Studios. Find all of our shows, notes, social, and links at www.pantheonpodcast.com. or wherever you listen to great podcasts. All songs can be found for purchase on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play. Please
purchases these great and important tracks. Find us on Facebook at The RNRAP. We are on Instagram at RNR Archaeology. Tweet us at RNR Archaeology.
92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
All because of a fancy bike?
It's not just a bike. Peloton makes treadmills, too.
Eh, all treadmills are the same.
Our treadmills can adjust speed and incline automatically, so you never break your stride. Whether you're squeezing in a power walk or training for a marathon, Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try the Peloton Tread risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.